You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hi, I'm Andrew Child, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 14, West Side Story, and with us today is Boston-based theater artist Carla Mirabal Rodriguez. Carla Mirabal Rodriguez is a Boston-based actor, director, and producer originally from San Juan, Puerto Rico. She has worked with theater companies such as Central Square Theater, Boston Playwrights Theater, Company One, Teatro Chelsea, and is the artistic assistant at The Huntington. Recent credits include Macbeth, Temporary, and Romeo and Juliet. She holds a BA in theater performance from Northeastern University. Carla, thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah, so I'd love to dive right in and sort of ask the big question, not to say, you know, why are you here today? What are you doing? But I would love to know, as a Puerto Rican theater artist, what do you have to say about West Side Story? What is your connection with the show in question, West Side Story?
Oh my gosh, how much time do you have? No. Well, of course, I would say it started early, right? Quote unquote early. Mm-hmm. Right. I heard about West Side Story right around the beginning of when I really started getting into theater and seeking out like all these movie musicals and things to see. When I was around, I don't know, after Les Mis came out, Les Mis movie. But I don't think I ever watched it until I was already in college. Some reason I probably couldn't find it, but I knew I had known about West Side Story anyway. It's just the minute you hear about anything theater and you are Puerto Rican, you know about West Side Story. It's kind of the first thing to come up. But I think first experience I had with West Side Story was actually my first audition in the United States when I came to audition for universities. And in my very first audition, which happened to be like this group audition setting, as if auditions aren't stressful enough. It was this group audition setting, and the person auditioning, who must have been something, a professor or something in that college, was looking at my resume, and she said, "Oh, you're Puerto Rican." And then said something along the lines of, "Do you want to live in America?" Like, very in the like tone of the America song from West Side Story.
Okay.
And I was just like, what do you do with that? What
right.
do you do
right.
When you are confronted with that? It was pretty unexpected. And it's not like I had any, in that moment, any like bad feelings about West Side Story or anything. It was just a little like, I don't know that that's the way I want to be identified.
Right. I mean, it would be one thing if you were to say, I was, you know, when people saw on my resume that I'm from Puerto Rico, that people are asking, have you ever been in West Side Story? Have you ever seen it? It's like another level to sort of do a joke from West Side Story.
It's kind of wild to just have this like, right, this like theater professional mm-hmm. who was a white woman mm-hmm. say to like sing this song at me while I'm about to audition for a program. Mm. So that was like kind of like a defining experience for what it gave me an idea of how West Side Story has defined what Puerto Rican is in American theater.
Okay. And so, do you think, was that experience an anomaly, or when you are meeting people who are working in theater, is their mind immediately saying, oh, like West Side Story?
It hasn't happened to such an extreme level.
Okay.
But it comes up. Like, West Side Story does come up. Yeah, it really is just, I mean, of course, now there's like a couple more things, right? Now there's In the Heights. There are more writers, there are more Latina voices in the mix, there are more Puerto Rican voices in the mix, but mm-hmm. still the thing that is like very well known is West Side Story. And the thing that you quickly learn is that everybody has an opinion about it. Mm-hmm. Puerto Ricans, like, there is no agreement. Like, there are people who hate it. There are people who love it. Mm. And then there's the nuance. And I like to think that I mostly live in the nuance. But then again, it's not like I actively try to make an active effort to participate in West Side Story either.
Okay. So, but you have seen, or you're familiar with, the original movie version.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And
I haven't seen it in a while, but
that's okay. Do you remember, like, what is your response to that? What are your feelings that come up with that movie, or what was your response at that time?
So the first thing is Rita Moreno being an icon. I just have to say, like, she is truly so inspiring. And I watched her documentary recently, which I just thought was amazing. It's just to see, in that sense of like, oh, this was her first real role. This was the first time she got to play a real person rather than just essentially being like a sexy Latina prop.
Right.
Which is what she had been interpreted as before.
Or a sexy, just non-white prop, you know, because it feels
like a lot of her early work, she was not always Latina.
Right. It was just like, well, you're not white, so you're gonna be Siamese, you're gonna be
ethnic,
yeah, whatever
quote unquote
we need.
Yeah.
But so seeing her in Anita and knowing that she is actually from Puerto Rico, is that something that sort of brings you into, like you said, some people can sit in the nuance with West Side Story. Was that something that kind of did that for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's like the first thing about it that drew me in, knowing that she was in that, because I knew who Rita Moreno, like,
okay,
as like an aspiring Puerto Rican actress, theater mm-hmm. maker growing up, I knew who Rita Moreno was, mm-hmm. but I hadn't really seen her in much. Like, it's just the kind of way that you, like, she has celebrity status, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I hadn't really seen her until I watched the actual film.
Okay.
So I would say she was like definitely the thing that drew me in. And then the thing that stopped me from watching it many times, it did take me a second to get through it,
mm-hmm.
was the fact that nobody else on it was, not only they weren't Puerto Rican, they weren't Latino.
Right.
Latina, okay. Latinx, period. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just a lot of brown face, including Rita Moreno, who they also, like, they darkened her skin tone to make her seem more like what was seen as the stereotypical Puerto Rican. Okay. So that definitely has to be acknowledged. It has a lot of, the movie has a lot of issues.
to say the least. So would you say, because now we have new adaptation, sort of a remake of the movie, if you will. And while I still think there's a lot we can discuss there, the issue you just hit upon is no longer as present, is no longer as prevalent, because they aren't actors in brown face playing different roles. They are Latinx actors. They are Puerto Rican performers. Do you think, does that solve all the problems in West Side Story and this movie gets a gold star?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I will say that is one thing, and that I am very glad to see. I am very glad to see all this new and established Latina talent being uplifted. I love that.
Mm.
What I don't love is how it is every... What I don't love is that the people behind the scenes are so... They are also white and male, usually. So we've got, Tony Kushner adapting the book. We've got Steven Spielberg directing. And then, of course, Sondheim wrote the music, Bernstein. Right. Sondheim wrote the lyrics, Bernstein wrote the music. We know this. So I would say that also causes a disconnect. And while I have not actually seen the remake, I have been reading a lot from specifically Puerto Rican theater makers, Puerto Rican filmmakers, and scholars saying, and just Puerto Rican people offering their opinions on like why they liked the film or why they didn't like the new film.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And is there any sense of consensus, or are you leaning more toward any arguments for or against enjoying or even seeing the movie?
I would say I'm probably just leaning against it because of that, because I know this happens all the time, but I just see this huge budget film and it is still, there are still things about it that they could have, but they didn't change. So in the end, in this story, the Puerto Ricans are always going to be the antagonists. The sharks are always going to be seen as the antagonists. That is the way the story is written. And that was not changed for the new movie, even if a little bit more nuance was thrown in there. And this has been something that I have been seeing crop up in articles of like, yes, you can solve these sort of like surface level problems, which of course were huge problems.
Right.
But in the end, what is the benefit of reviving this story, this movie, this iconic movie that really defined in not just the theater space, but just culturally defined for the world what Puerto Ricans were, and what Puerto Ricans look like, what Puerto Ricans sound like, what Puerto Ricans are like, and that painted a very violent image, which coming from this place, like, right, I'm Puerto Rican, I grew up there, my whole family is there, I moved here when I was 18 to go to college, so I very much am still like, home is Puerto Rico, right?
Okay.
So seeing that, and even just hearing the words like, let it sink back in the ocean, like that hurts. That is hearing those things and knowing that they weren't, this is not like a Puerto Rican critiquing Puerto Rico. Like, this was a white person
who
wrote this.
Putting words in the Puerto Rican characters' mouths.
And then when you add the lens of colonialism onto it, when you add the fact that, you know, Steven Spielberg had said that he wanted to revive this movie because he wanted to draw attention to the situation at the US-Mexico border. But Puerto Ricans are US citizens. Like Puerto Rico is a US territory, but if you ask a Puerto Rican, they're more likely to call it a colony, or at least let me not speak for all Puerto Ricans. If you ask me, I would call it a colony, because that is very much the way it feels and the way a lot of laws and rules and boards are imposed upon us. So people, or at least I don't recall being talked about in the movie, the reason they migrated was because of colonial reasons.
Right. Right.
And so it kind of fails, and I can't speak for the new movie, of course, but it kind of fails to represent that aspect of it all.
So I'm curious, because not only do we have two very popular movie adaptations, we also have, you know, there was a recent Broadway revival that sort of re-envisioned the whole thing, pared it down, Ivo Van Hove. Shortly before that, Arthur Lawrence came in and directed a Broadway revival that Lin-Manuel came in and rewrote some of the libretto for. We at the Bernstein Centennial, we saw everyone around the country sort of engaging with these conversations, like, does Maria have to be sung by a Puerto Rican performer if we're just doing the songs out of context, you know, and other conversations like that. So it really does feel like West Side Story is still popular, is still being programmed, is still being seen. I'm curious, because you've worked as a performer, you've worked as a director, you also work in an administrative capacity with different theaters. What would you say to an eager producer who's saying, I'm going to revive West Side Story in the season in 2022?
Well, my first question would be, why?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Why this specific piece? Other than, you know, if the answer is going to be money, that's, to me, that's going to be disappointing. Even though I do understand that it is something that will likely sell very well.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially right now with the film, like, this is something that I'm sure we're going to start seeing even more revivals crop up now that the film just came out. So that'll be my first question. Then my next follow-up question would be, can you program something if you want, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe their mission isn't to accurately represent Puerto Ricans, but I would say, would you consider maybe doing a play by an actual Latina person, like an actual Latina playwright, and putting those funds towards that? Because there are so many amazing ones. And the thing that is still really missing are multiple Latina perspectives. And then if they say, we really want to do a musical that will sell tickets, I'll say, okay, do In the Heights, you know?
Okay. Would you say that In the Heights is, not just from a commercial standpoint, but from the standpoint of representation, from the standpoint of equity, from the standpoint artistically, is In the Heights, would you say, a worthy counterpoint to the portrayal of Puerto Ricans in West Side Story?
I would say it's definitely much more generous. And one of the reasons I'm in theater is because my high school did a production of In the Heights.
Oh, wow.
And it was the first time I wasn't in it, which is still a regret to this day that I did an audition.
Interesting.
But I saw it, and it was the first time I was hearing this music, and I was like, this is music that is home to me. Like, this is an thinking that this could possibly be seen on a Broadway stage, and that people were actually experiencing this and enjoying it. And I was just thinking, this feels like me. Like, this is something that is so familiar to me, and it hits me so deep. And I would see these characters on the stage, and I would think, these are real people. I know these people. And there's just such a depth to them. And there's more nuance there, and there's more types of people, rather than the way I think West Side Story really plays to stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
I think In the Heights offers more perspectives. This is the thing that I deeply believe, no piece is ever going to be perfect, which is why we need more representation, because when it becomes that we are putting all of our eggs in one basket, like, we only have this one thing to represent us, which was the thing with West Side Story for so long. If we only have this one thing that we can point to and say, there we are, not everybody's going to be there. It's impossible for one thing to A, be perfect, and B, like, encompass the entirety of what, in the case of In the Heights, it means to be a Latino in New York.
I'm curious, when you compare In the Heights to West Side Story, how much of that nuance, how much of that familiarity you felt for the characters, do you think can we chalk up to, well, it came decades later and the art form had progressed? And how much do you feel like we can chalk up to there were actually Latinx people in control who were writing this story, who were writing this music, who were creating these characters, performing these characters? Would you say that one of those two or something else is more to credit for that big difference, the jump from West Side to In the Heights?
Well, it's definitely both and.
Okay.
Is right, like that's my immediate answer of, well, yes, definitely in the US in particular, something like In the Heights, well, would not have been funded in the times of West Side Story. Like it was I do see that in its time, its depiction of even just Puerto Ricans as humans was seen as revolutionary. I do see that for its time. But it is 2022, right? 2021 when the remake got made. At this point, I think we can do better. I think we know better. I think more money should be going to Latina artists telling their own stories, which is what In the Heights did. And right. That's just one example, right? There are other plays. There are other Latina creators. But yeah, I mean, that's what happens when you have that sort of that genuine perspective of you don't need to do research to understand what it means to just be a Latina person living in the world. Like maybe you should, because Latina people aren't a monolith. So regardless, you probably should do some, but you are starting from a much more genuine point of view to be able to tell the story.
So I guess I'm a little bit curious. So in this book, we sort of have to jump, if we're just looking at Latino representation in theater, we have West Side Story, and then decades later, we come to In the Heights, and then just a few chapters later, we get to Hamilton. And I'm curious, is the answer to everything, like, bring in Lin-Manuel? Because it seems to, at a certain point, it does seem like Broadway and Disney and I think at one point, like, Star Wars, like, they're all just saying, oh, we can fix this. Get Lin-Manuel consulting. Get him rewriting or reworking or translating or something. Just get his name on it. Is that the solution, or is there something else that these theaters should be thinking about, should be engaging with?
Listen, I love that Lin-Manuel is getting so much work. I love it. I think he's wonderful. Of course. He's just one human being, though. So I think we need more than that, because, right, it's sort of like when you flip the narrative and you think, like you would never just be like, oh yeah, this one white person is like perfect for absolutely everything. Like, yes, right. Every project they can just do that. And that's obviously not like a great example, but sort of the way to put it into context of, yeah, he's one human. He's a great artist. And he is truly opening so many doors and creating so much work for artists of color in general. But it's a lot to put on one person. And it definitely shouldn't be, because, you know, everybody has their own perspective, and there are still perspectives that are missing, especially within Latinx theater, like, and Latinx filmmaking and storytelling. Like, there's so much, of course, nuance. I keep saying Latinx people aren't a monolith. There are so many countries. There are white Latinos, there are indigenous Latinos, there are Afro Latinos. And they're at certain points, especially when it comes to being in the US, some perspectives get erased. And that often comes at the cost of the perspectives of indigenous Latinx peoples and Afro Latinx people.
So you sort of hit on that In the Heights was a formative experience for you.
Yes.
Have you been able to see productions of it since high school, or were you able to see the movie version or anything like that?
Yeah. I saw a version of it at Wheelock Family Theater.
Okay.
In Boston a few years ago. That was pre-pandemic. Right. I don't remember when they did it, but it was definitely pre-pandemic. So I think that's the only other version I've been able to see live.
Okay.
But I did see the movie. Yes.
And what did you think about that movie? Like, was that a good experience or similar to seeing it at your high school, or it fell flat?
So much to say about it, but like in general, I did have that feeling of like, oh my gosh, I do love this. This is like the sounds of it, mm-hmm. just like the sounds, the Spanish of it. It all feels so genuine and so, I can't even explain. I feel it so deeply in my soul where I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel seen by this.
Mm.
But recognizing that not everybody felt that way. And right. this is also part of what I think we don't have nearly enough. We don't have nearly enough representation. One piece cannot encompass all, but maybe a better job should have been done in terms of casting for that.
Mm.
There's also one thing that like really, one story that wasn't in the movie that really bothered me, because it is in the original musical,
mm-hmm.
is Nina's dad doesn't want Nina to date Benny specifically because Benny is Black. And that is a plot point in the musical, but it is not, it has been taken out of the movie and replaced with a different narrative. Of course there were plenty of shifts between the two,
right.
but that was one thing that I very much missed being acknowledged, at least in the film, because there is racism in Latinx countries that doesn't stop existing. And for that part of it to just not come into the movie, like racism within Latinx communities rather than mm-hmm. like racism outside coming in.
Okay.
That was something that I know a lot of other people also felt were missing from that narrative. That felt important to acknowledge, especially now.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll go back, because you have these positive things that you said about In the Heights, seen, feeling like there is some nuance, even if it didn't totally translate to the movie. I'm curious as a theater artist and ostensibly as someone who's engaging with theater as an audience member as well, are there performances you've seen or that you've been a part of? Are there artists whose work you really have gotten to admire, whether you've seen it or engaged with it in a different way? Or are there groups that you think are consistently putting forth work that you could say the same about, that you feel seen, that you feel like are bringing nuance to the table, or that are giving that level of depth to the representation of the Latinx community?
Yes, sorry, you were cutting out a bit, but I got the gist of the question.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. So first of all, a theater company that I worked with and still am very close to, Teatro Chelsea, they are based in Chelsea, Massachusetts, which is just right outside of Boston. And Chelsea has a very large immigrant community, specifically from Central America.
Mm-hmm.
So they are doing some really incredible work. While I was there, we worked on a new play festival, specifically to highlight Latina voices and Latina playwrights and help to develop their work. And they're actually going to be doing their first world premiere. In the summer 2022. Don't have exact dates, but summer 2022. So that kind of thing is really exciting. We also worked with In the Margin, which is a theater company out in California that really works to highlight indigenous Latina voices and indigenous voices in general. So they're very wonderful. Because it's not all about me being seen. Like, my perspective should not be the only thing I see. It's something right. I also deeply believe. So they're wonderful. There's so many artists. Oh my gosh. I mean, Melinda Lopez has been a huge inspiration to me. She is a playwright based here in Boston. Mm-hmm. I have the pleasure of now working with her. And she is so lovely.
And how is that getting to work with someone that you admire, like Melinda Lopez, who is fabulous?
It is the best.
Good.
She's so wonderful. I assistant directed her play. Her play is Sonia Flew, but Teatro Chelsea did Sonia Se Fue, which is the Spanish translation of it. Mm. And it was actually a Zoom play. And so that even just getting to talk with her about it over the phone, she just like offers such incredible insight to things. And now I'm getting to work on another one of her plays. So I just truly, I love Melinda a lot. And I just think she has such a unique voice and an important voice. Theater companies that are doing really right. Most of my knowledge lies in Boston because this is where I live.
Right.
But I mean, of course, in New York, there's the Puerto Rican traveling theater, Pregones, like they've mm-hmm. been around forever, or not forever, yeah. but they are very well established and still very important to the community overall. Mm. So they're really great. Oh my gosh, who else? I mean, they're just playwrights that I truly just so deeply admire and hope to get the chance to work with. Like Jose Rivera is one of my favorite playwrights.
Mm. You have a favorite play that you would love to work on by Rivera?
Oh my gosh. I love Marisol because it's so kooky. Like, it's so weird.
Me too. I'm so and glad I just, you said that. I love that play. Cool. Would you say, and this just sort of came to mind, these names that you're mentioning, these theaters that you're mentioning, would they also make your list if we were to say there are listeners right now who are hearing this and saying, oh yeah, the only Latinx theater I'm familiar with is from this book. It's two Lin-Manuel musicals and West Side Story, if we qualify that as Latinx theater. Would these names, Jose Rivera, Melinda Lopez, would those be a good starting place for people to be looking if they want to read more or see more Latinx theater?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. And these are like, their plays are not hard to find. You can, mm-hmm.
right.
like, they are, you could likely go into like whatever your nearest bookstore is, check out their play section. There's also, I would also say, like, in terms of not just plays, but reading Latin American writers, there is some like really incredible Latin American literature, and most of it has been translated and is, or not most of it, but a lot of the most popular stuff has been translated and is available, and it's so different. I mean, it's some of my favorite works. Like Isabel Allende is my favorite novelist, and she writes a lot of magical realism, and that's so fun to look at. Also Kiara Udes Alegría, like she wrote the book for In the Heights, and right. she is a playwright. She has many plays out. She also has a book out as well. So even just looking at the people who like contributed to these works, like you can definitely find more in their own body of work.
She has, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe she did, now I can't think of the name of it. She had a musical though. Miss You Like Hell. Were you able to ever see that anywhere?
I haven't. Okay. I got so close to directing a production of it once, and then we couldn't get the rights.
Oh, no.
But
okay.
I have listened to the music. It's fun. It's deep.
Mm.
It's good.
It's also devastating. If
yes.
folks listening want to give it a listen, I'd recommend it. Some of the songs, first of all,
it takes you on a journey.
It literally takes you on a journey. There is actually a journey, but it does. Some of the songs, just warning, are so catchy. They'll never leave your head.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a devastating musical, I think. I mean, ultimately, there's a lot of uplift. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of joy. But ultimately,
the overall arc
yeah is not not a happy ending, no spoilers, but yeah, that's all really fabulous, really good stuff. So I'd also love to ask if we have any listeners, because, you know, we've got people all over the spectrum listening to this show. If we have listeners who are in Puerto Rico or are elsewhere in the world thinking about coming to the United States to study theater, to work in theater, would you have anything that you would say to them? Any advice, any messages, anything?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, don't let people put you into a box. Don't let people define who you are and tell you what you should want to do. Because that's something that I ran into quite a bit, especially with typecasting and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, you're going to have to fight for it, but fight to do what you want to do and fight for the things that you want to do. And then also the other thing I would say, just in general, remain curious, remain so curious, try things out, just because you never really know. I also came into my bachelor's like not knowing much beyond acting. I came in very clearly set on, I'm an actor and that is it. And I don't do anything else. And then I happened upon a directing class. And then I was like, I had a whole crisis where I was like, wait, am I a director? Am I not an actor? And then I was like, why can't I be both? Why couldn't I do both? And then cut forward like another year, I'm like, wait, this producing thing, that's interesting. That's a whole different perspective. That I never, not that I never thought I would enjoy, that I just simply wasn't aware of. I didn't know what a producer did. I didn't know what that, how that job differed from like a stage manager, like when I first started out, you know, that kind of thing.
Which is a great place to be if you're looking up to and working with someone like Melinda Lopez, who as a playwright has, I believe, a day named after her in the city of Boston.
She does.
But Melinda Lopez Day. Also, every once in a while, you go and see a show in Boston and you open the program and it's, you know, featuring Melinda Lopez with, you know, the little asterisk, like proud member of Actors Equity, you know? And she's someone who, I don't know, I don't want to speak for her, but she epitomizes to me this ability to excel and succeed in multiple areas of this art form, of this industry.
She is definitely an inspiration to me of, I can be more than one thing. Like, I don't, because I, you know, the freelance life, not to say it's hard. The freelance life is so hard.
The freelance life, you have to be more than one thing, you know?
You have to be. You really do. You need a day job. You need, but you need flexibility and you need to be able to wrap your head around your taxes. So there's all that kind of fun stuff. But I just, like, to me, I was like, I know that I want not just like a little more stability. I also wanted to be able to feel like I'm consistently making a mark on something and I'm not always moving from one thing to the next. Which is also good. It's all good and well. This is like just speaking for myself. That part of me that wanted to like sort of like have an impact and have a voice, it felt like I wasn't getting that need totally filled without having something like Walt Theater Chelsea and now the Huntington, like where I get to have a more artistic voice and be part of that producing side of things.
That's great.
All the while still loving to perform, still love directing, just all of the things. Hopefully not all at once. Try to not let it be all at once.
Yeah, I don't know if Melinda Lopez has ever done that. I don't know. She might have. If anyone
she probably has.
If anyone has.
Oh, you know, she definitely has. She wrote Mala.
Oh, you're right.
And then she performed in it.
You're right. And that's when the city names a day after you. When you do that successfully at a major regional theater, they say, listen, you get a holiday because
you deserve a day.
Because
she does. She really does.
She does deserve a day. Read her work, listeners. Check her out. Melinda Lopez.
Absolutely.
She's fabulous.
Becoming Cuba. Mala. Mm. She did an adaptation of Yerma, a musical adaptation of Yerma. Oh my gosh, another amazing person, Melia Ben Susan, who is the artistic director of Hartford Stage.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. She's also great.
So now I'm curious, and I promise I'm not just doing that thing where it's like, let's go back to what we're supposed to be talking about.
No.
I genuinely am curious because now we've talked about some people who, when it came to mind when you mentioned Becoming Cuba, if you look up images from Melinda Lopez's Becoming Cuba when it was presented at the Huntington, it's possibly one of the most gorgeous stage designs that you'll ever see. And I think, you know, credit where credit's due, Melinda does work frequently when she's at the Huntington with scenic designer Cameron Anderson, who has like fabulous vision. But I think Melinda's texts just lend themselves to this extreme beauty. So you mentioned, we were talking about Melinda Lopez, and then you mentioned Melia Ben Susan. Do you think when we're talking about names like this, if Melinda Lopez were to rewrite the book of West Side Story and Melia Ben Susan were to direct it, is there a world where this libretto or some snippet of this, some moment of this is salvageable and could become something with this kind of beauty and depth? I also promise that I don't necessarily think the answer is yes. So I'm open to whatever your thoughts are on that.
Yeah. Oh, man, that would be the case where I'm suddenly like, oh, do I want to work on this? Like, that would be the moment where I'm like, wait. But I very much go back to, and this is, again, nothing mm-hmm. against any, like, people, nothing against particularly Puerto Ricans who love West Side Story, because I struggle with it, because I'm like, I think the music is actually, like, stunning. I do in fact think the music is great. It's just really hard for me to like disconnect that from like my own experiences and like knowing how hard it is to like even just get your work seen and produced as a Latinx artist. And I'm not even a playwright, but you know, it's hard. It's hard. And there's a lot of people out there trying to make it happen, and it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
And then seeing like this multi-million dollar movie get made helmed by all these white folks, but also just what movie it is.
Uh-huh.
There are just some problems with it that I think are too integral to the story. Like the fact that it is gangs. Like if you take away the gang aspect, does it keep being West Side Story?
Right.
Like, does it continue to do that? Like, if you take away that Chino kills Tony at the end, is it still West Side Story? Like, is it still all these things? So that's when I just question, like, originally it is an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet.
Which,
so I guess at one point, at what point are you just like, all right, forget Romeo and Juliet, West Side Story is its own thing.
Uh-huh.
But maybe somebody can wrap their head around it, but I'm not totally sure that I'm there yet.
Okay. Yeah, which is totally fine. We'll totally allow that. You got to work on, it was a bilingual production of Romeo and Juliet. Could you shed a little light on what that looks like, what that process is like, what that production was like?
Oh my gosh, so it was outdoors. Let's start there. It was outdoors in the summer of 2021 when it felt like we might be free of COVID, but then we weren't. But it was outdoors. I will say it was just such a lovely ensemble. It really, really was. Like, I'm still very good friends with a lot of the people I got to work with there. But it was definitely like trying to make it not be West Side Story. Like trying to just, it was trying to just be like, oh, okay. The families weren't necessarily separated by language. So there were people, although Juliet did speak English, Juliet spoke English, Romeo spoke Spanish.
Okay.
But there were people on the Capulet side who spoke Spanish and people on the Montague side who spoke English. So it was kind of like having more of a mix. And I would say the like goal of it was to just make it more accessible specifically to the community of Chelsea, which has so many Spanish speakers.
Okay. Which you mentioned there is a huge community in Chelsea. Was that something conscious in the room? Like, we're not doing West Side Story. We're not going to be close to West Side Story. Or is that just sort of in hindsight?
I don't think it was actually. I think we would get asked about it.
Okay.
But it wasn't like an attitude in the room. Like, nobody came into it being like, it's West Side Story.
Okay.
I think maybe we like talked about it at the beginning of the process. Because I was assistant director on that.
Mm-hmm.
So we probably talked about it like when coming up with the concept of it and talking about design and all that kind of stuff. But it wasn't, once we hit the rehearsal room, I don't recall it being like such a present thing.
Okay. Got it. Well, thank you so much for making the time to chat with me today about West Side Story. I really appreciate hearing your thoughts.
We went on such a tangent, but I'm not mad about it.
No, me neither. I think this was fabulous. So thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Next, I'm speaking with Caridad Sevik. Caridad Sevik won a 2012 Obie for Lifetime Achievement. Sevik has been a guest artist at the Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh and the Royal Court Theatre, and has taught playwriting workshops at Payne's Plough Theatre in London and the US-Cuba Writers' Conference in Havana. Sevik sustains a career as a theatrical translator as well, mainly of the dramatic work of Federico Garcia Lorca. She has received fellowships from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and the California Arts Council. She has trained for 4 consecutive years with Maria Irene Fornes.
Hello, Caridad. I'm so happy you could be here today.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. So let's dive right in. Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with and your perceptions of West Side Story?
I mean, sure. I think that for a lot of people, this is maybe, I mean, it's a canonical musical. and, you know, my first encounter with it was with the first film version, the 1961 version, seeing it, I think, on TV. It might have been on TV at some point or some channel. And just being, I was captivated by the music, which is story. I think I'd heard, you know, I'd obviously had heard like Somewhere and Maria and There's a Place for Us. And, you know, in like Barbara Streisand recordings and stuff like that. You know, so I sort of knew it as a, like a pop culture phenomenon and that it was based on Romeo and Juliet. And so I was like, oh, okay. But I'd never seen the film. So I saw the film, I remember on TV when I was, I don't know, as an adolescent. And I was like, and I remember not really liking it very much. I was just, but I couldn't articulate why. Do you know, I was a little bit like, oh, why does this have to happen to these characters? And why are the Puerto Rican characters being sacrificed continually throughout the film in favor of, you know, upholding kind of a white power structure? Mm-hmm. And specifically, I would say, you know, interestingly, I think given the politics of the story as it's represented in this iteration, so I'm not going to talk about Romeo and Juliet for a second, but in this iteration, so it's its own thing, is that I feel like the white working class is pitted against the Puerto Rican working class in this film. And in the middle of that, I think, is this other story, which is the aspirational white middle class. Mm-hmm. And that actually what's happening, I think, in the storytelling is that everybody's scrambling to be part of the white middle class. And there's a kind of alignment with political whiteness that's happening in just the narrative, like the structures of the narrative, in terms, and determines who gets to be sacrificed, where, when, and how, and including, you know, if we fast forward now to the recent film version, you know, here's this new character called Valentina, played by Rita Moreno, who at the end of the film basically sacrifices Chino to the police, right? So it hands him in. Mm-hmm. Reupholding that power structure. And of course, you know, I'm sure we've all seen the mini debate on Twitter about, Maria sleeps with Tony after her brother is killed, which of course is in Shakespeare. It's also problematic in Shakespeare, but I think that given the politics of West Side Story, what happens is that it positions Maria as someone who will do anything to kind of literally sleep with the white power structure, right? And that, you know, my brother's sacrificed, who else is being sacrificed? You could argue that Anita is sort of sacrificed in the storytelling because she's assaulted. So the brown bodies in the storytelling are kind of pushed aside in favor of the white or white assimilating bodies. I find that, you know, obviously I find that incredibly problematic and needless to say. And I also think the fact that it's the musical that for a lot of people, maybe, you know, like, okay, I'll phrase this this way, which is that if you're a Latin A person, Latin A, Latinx person, and you're moving through politically white spaces, invariably, as an artist, you'll be like, West Side Story. Uh-huh. Don't you just love it? You know what I mean? There's a kind of like, you're aligned with that because it was, I mean, truthfully, it was a mainstream film. The 1961 film is a mainstream film that mm-hmm. featured not all the actors. There was a lot of brown face happening in that film, but there were, you know, Rita Moreno, like there was a kind of notion, a kind of bid to representation. And so for a lot of people that was like, oh, Puerto Ricans exist. You know, and so, you know, and the music is not actually Puerto Rican. I mean, the music is colonial. I mean, Bernstein is doing Spanish kind of structures in the music. He's doing flamenco, paso doble, like, you know, and so, but it somehow gets people, so it kind of, I mean, the music is also reinforcing colonialism, which I think is fascinating. So, but that becomes sort of a reference point. Like if you're a Latin person and an artist that you can't not deal with a West Side Story because it's just there and it's sitting there as a monolith. And I think that the opportunity of the film, the new film, was like, oh, what are they going to do? What are they going to do? And so maybe I'll stop and let you kind of intervene.
No. This is. Did you feel like, what did they do? Did the new film respond to anything you've sort of touched on in a way that you thought progressed from the original movie or from the original libretto? Or did you feel like same problems are still there, maybe just in a different reframing?
Yeah, I think the same problems are still there.
Okay.
With some cushioning around it, right? So, we have Spanish spoken in the film, but it's not translated. in the subtitles. Boo hiss. So again, the language is kind of demoted, right? In terms of it doesn't occupy the same hierarchical space as English. We have, you know, the Puerto Rican national anthem. The revolutionary version of the anthem is sung briefly. But that's kind of like an Easter egg. Like, I think that, you know, most audiences wouldn't know that that's what's happening. There's like a mural and the first confrontation with the gang members, which, you know, if you're looking at the mural, you know, it's not there for a very long time on frame. Mm-hmm. But if you see it, it's kind of like calling back to Puerto Rican leaders fighting for independence on the island. So there's some weaving. Obviously, the casting, we've mm-hmm. now have Latina actors playing those roles with I think addressing, you know, after Latinidad, you know, in the casting, which is really important. And I think it's fascinating to look at the politics of casting Rachel Zegler and Ariana DeBose, because Rachel could be considered white passing for some folks. And of course, she's the character that's climbing the white ladder in the film. But I think and of course, there's, you know, Chino is now, like at the beginning of the film, at least until other things happen, becomes, you know, is now a student and mm-hmm. is not initially a gang member and all of that. But I still feel that, you know, I mean, it's funny, you know, and I don't know what the legalities of the estate are in terms of making radical changes, right. But I thought, oh, this is an incredible opportunity to actually change the ending, change that, you know, to actually do things that kind of really bust it open and not reinforce the same narrative upon these characters and give them a different kind of agency. And maybe have them recognize the traps that they're in. You know, I mean, the sort of white middle class aspirational trap is how they're being pitted against each other. You know, that power structure is actually what's determining this. I mean, one of the things that's determining this white supremacy is like white supremacy is this kind of like you will fight each other for the crumbs, you know, to death, mm-hmm. while, you know, everyone else is like the powers that be, the invisible powers that be are actually moving everything around, you know? And so I think that is, I think, slightly more illuminated in this film through some of the staging and maybe in thinking about it, or maybe just time has caught up with it. You know, mm-hmm. I do think that they amplify Tony quite a bit. His narrative gets kind of a little bit of boosting. Uh-huh. And I think that to that degree, I'm like, why?
Okay. Yeah.
You know, because it's like, you know, actually, first of all, I mean, I can't even begin with Ansel Elgort, but I just can't. But also I think that actually hurts the film, interestingly, I think, to have that storyline boosted, because it privileges his storyline, you know, like, right. Why not boost somebody else's story? You know, like, why not boost Anita's storyline more, or Bernardo's storyline more, or, you know, like, I feel like, so it weirdly, I mean, the film is very, you know, both films are very, super complicated. I think this film, because it's coming from Spielberg and Kushner, I think is exceptionally complicated in that regard, because they're both, I think, I can only assume, are aware of all these issues, you know. Mm-hmm. This is me thinking the best of everyone, you know. Right, I assume they're aware of these issues. And therefore, oh, you can actually address them even further. Instead of right now, what feels like a little bit of lip service is being paid, but not actually a full digging into the problematics of the story and how it resonates in it. And I think what hurts me more, you know, having, you know, Ariana, I mean, obviously she's doing great work and she won the Oscar and many other awards, and for her to say, like, on national television, we all aspire to play Anita, you know, that was, like, mm-hmm. our dream role. And I was like, no!
Right.
like, no, that should not be the role that you're aspiring to play. That should be, like, not the role that, like, all Latina actors are aspiring to play. Like, And so I think that by her saying that, she's kind of like reinforcing that idea of like, see, this is the role I always wanted to play, and therefore everyone else is always aspiring to this. And it's like, no, we need to like demolish all of that and like start over and like choose other stories. And plenty of them exist, for one thing. We have plenty of writers, you know. So I think that an artist making work, and and of course now with the awards and everything, I mean, then that film will now be part of the canon too, and
right,
it'll just perpetuate itself. So I have obviously have issues, you know, but I still love listening to Somewhere and Tonight and all those songs.
Do you think
they're great songs?
Because the music is so beautiful, so iconic, do you think, is it worthwhile for someone somewhere to attack this and go full on and restructure, replot, rewrite the book? Or do you think it's just like, we can move on, we can do something else now?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, a part of me wishes that it could happen.
Okay.
Like just do a complete restructuring with that incredible score. Because why not? That would be fun. As a, just a dramatic project. But I can only imagine that it's probably legally not possible to do that. But then I also think we can move on, and like it's there, and it's been there, and it's not gonna, it's never going to go away. Do you know what I mean? So,
right.
So I think the effort needs to be in boosting new stories and, you know, making sure they're heard, and, new narratives and new characters and stuff like that, not returning continually to the source of what has been a lot of pain for many people.
Well, one question that I asked to Carla, because in this book, there's a chapter on West Side Story, and then decades later, we've got the chapter on In the Heights, and sort of in between and since then, do you have any other shows that you think students of musical theater history, people who are interested in this book, in this podcast, any shows that put Latine, Latinx people on stage or are involved with the creative process? Do you have shows that they should be checking out, that they should be interested in?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Zoot Suit. Are you guys doing a chapter on Zoot Suit?
No chapter on Zoot Suit. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? I know.
What's happening? No, I mean, it's a music, you know, I think of it as a musical, you know, maybe people think of it as a play with songs, you know, but it certainly qualifies as a musical in my book. And and I think that there should be, I'm actually surprised that there aren't more revivals of Zoot Suit. I don't, maybe it's because the cast is quite large, but that's true of other shows as well. This notion of the universal is really fascinating, because West Side Story is seen as a universal thing, and Zoot Suit is seen as a niche, a niche thing only about Chicano culture. I think it's also like a universal story. You know what I mean? If we're going to play the universal game, then I would say that's as universal as and belongs alongside the West Side Stories of the world, right? So. So I definitely would say Zoot Suit. I think there was also like a, you know, I don't know if there's even a recording of this show, but it wasn't a gazillion years ago. It was like it might have been in the 90s, maybe early 2000s. No, maybe it was the 90s. There was a musical called, I'm going to get the title butchered, so you might have to look it up, but it's something like, Five Guys and Maria. It's one of the first, like mid. It was done in New York. Five guys named Jose and Maria, or something like that. It was directed by Susana Tubert. Mm-hmm. It was a commercial musical. It ran for a little while, kind of in a commercial Midtown space. It was kind of like a very, very pre, like super pre, obviously, historically, In the Heights. But was positioned as, a commercial Latine musical. And it's never been revived.
Oh, wow.
It had that short run.
Yeah.
Yeah. Five guys. I think it's like five guys named Jose and a girl named Maria. It's got like, you know, it's got like a funny title like that. I think if you just look up five guys named Jose and Susanna Tubert, it will come up in like archives from the New York Times or something. Mm. It was favorably reviewed. Okay. It had an audience. It never moved to Broadway, you know, but it did play Midtown. It was a Midtown show, and it was like a mid-sized budget show.
Okay.
And quite, you know, in a way significant, and I think kind of been erased from, obviously it's been kind of weirdly erased from history. Mm. I'm bringing it back. And so that show I think is worth looking at. There was also like a version of Graciela Daniel did a piece around the music of Astor Piazzolla.
Okay.
Also in the 90s, a kind of dance theater, but with like songs that played Lincoln Center.
Oh, wow.
If memory serves. Yeah, it was like a Lincoln Center. You know, this is like, I feel like it's like the heyday that will never come back. But it was it was Lincoln Center and INTAR. INTAR Hispanic American Arts Theater, which is a very super small company, right? Budget size, collaborated. They collaborated first on a musical version of Chronicle of a Death Foretold,
mm-hmm.
which is really interesting. And then they worked on this tango project with Graciela Daniel and the music of Piazzolla. And it had a commercial run. And then it's never been seen again. So I think that there's something around digging into some of these shows that were at the beginning of like what some people call the first multicultural boom mm-hmm. in the U.S., where there was like funding all of a sudden. Suddenly there was funding for some uh-huh. things and interest, right? And to see if there's – to kind of trace that genealogy a little bit.
Mm.
Before In the Heights, because In the Heights didn't come out of nowhere, actually.
Right.
Although it seems, you know, it sort of burst onto the scene in a very bold way, but there were like steps along the way to make that happen. You know, and then to look at the work of, you know, Dolores Prida, I think, worked on a musical for a while that again, played kind of smaller venues. So I think look at like the writers that were working in Latinx spaces that were actually making musicals. And I will say that Repertorio Español, you know, in New York City has been doing musicals for a while. You know, none of them have moved to Broadway, but they have been done, you know, and they absolutely all Latine everything, right? And it's sort of fascinating that they don't get reviewed, you know, in the same way with the same attention.
Do you think when we talk about this first multicultural boom,
yeah,
do you think are we building up for another something like that? Just looking at sort of what is coming on the scene, what we are seeing as commercially viable currently.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, I think it's funny because I think there've been like I was. like in the 90s, so there was this period in like the mid 80s where suddenly there was money started to appear, like suddenly there were, right? I mean, there was also, it had to do with like writers and artists that foundations and theaters were kind of like, oh, we should be promoting them, right? You know, so you get in like the early 90s, you start to get late 80s, early 90s, you get like Jose Rivera's writing and Eduardo Machado's writing and Cedi Moraga's writing and Lynn Alvarez, you know, there is a kind of extraordinary, you know, it does feel like a boom of just artists that are making like really compelling, beautiful work that is getting produced, right? You know, so suddenly, and a lot of it was getting produced, not just in Latinx spaces, but also in historically white spaces. So suddenly there was this attention and a desire to nurture and develop artists, right? So out of that, you get like all these development programs, like South Coast Rep had their program and INTAR had theirs, and like, you know, exponential. All of that sort of died down and when Nilo Cruz won the Pulitzer Prize.
Okay.
Literally that same year, like a lot of those programs, like the South Coast Rose program, got shut down. There was a kind of like mentality of, well, now that Nilo's won the Pulitzer, we're done. Like, we're sort of done developing. Like, we did our work, okay. You know? And this was coming from PWI. So there was this feeling of like, check, we did that. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, Latinx companies were and still are scrambling for dollars. Like, this, I think the irony of all of this is that you have privileged white institutions getting funding to develop Latin artists, Latinx companies who have been historically developing artists and making work and producing work, getting less funding. You know, it gets kind of divided up, right? And so you have like very little still, you have the same scramble for dollars with Latinx companies that you did in 1995. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, which is shameful, right? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you have In the Heights, and you have Hamilton, and you have Encanto, and you have, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it does feel like we're in a new, like, oh, this could make money.
Right.
This
right.
could make money.
I like this.
I like this. This is good. Let's sell this. We'll see. I mean, I think, you know, my sort of hat is always that I'm slightly skeptical of everything. And partly because I feel like I keep wondering, okay, that's awesome. People are getting work and the work is being platformed and reaching wide audiences. That's awesome. And maybe it means more work will happen. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And more people will get jobs and all those things. And be trusted to tell their stories, right? What I'm skeptical of is a little bit, sometimes a lot, but a little bit about how the power is being held and what are the value systems behind those power structures that are upholding the work. And I think that is obviously a much more complicated question around decadent capitalism and political agendas that are tied to that. But I feel like that's where the thorn is, you know, I think. And that's going to take a while to dig out.
Yeah.
Maybe forever. Forever.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed, hopefully not, but thank you so much for making time to chat with me today. This was
yay,
wonderful.
Totally fun. I hope it was useful.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today. Please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about West Side Story, please also review the links in the below description. I am Andrew Child, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.